What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Hi, everybody, and here's what's ahead. The NASDAQ and the S&P jumping to fresh highs again today as the bulls remain firmly in charge. But the charts are flashing some warning signals, the same kind we saw at that market top in January 2018. We'll have that for you. Plus, a miss on the ADP jobs report today ahead of Friday's big employment number. But the numbers aren't telling the whole story. We'll look at what recruiters are saying about the rate of job growth and where that job growth is. It might surprise you. And $8 billion for a dating app. DraftKings stock soars as it partners with Air Jordan. Credit cards rethink rewards and good luck getting a bike these days. But we do begin with these markets, and Dom Chu is here with those numbers.
You need a bike, but you don't need it to ride higher because the markets will do it for you these days. Kelly Evans, green across the screen. It wasn't that case earlier on in the session. The NASDAQ was actually showing, believe it or not, some weakness on the day. But the Dow Industrials are still just about 2.5% below their record levels. Not just there yet, but still 28,903. The S&P 500, though, we'll put a little gold star up here, and for the NASDAQ composite as well. Both of these hit record intraday highs in trading today. But again, some weakness in technology stocks was taking that NASDAQ into negative territory at one point. One place, though, that is not negative within the NASDAQ is the computer chip industry, semiconductors. This ETF, the ticker SMH, VanEck Vector Semiconductor ETF, is up 2% today, off its best levels of the session slightly. But this gets another gold star because that is at record highs as well. Semiconductors continue to outperform some analyst coverage on NVIDIA and others, helping to drive that trade today. And then take a look at these momentum names. We've talked about them a lot over the course of the past several months here. Apple, Tesla, Zoom Video. You can see all of these fairly deeply in the red. Apple is gaining some ground here. All of these are off the lows of the session still. They've been real outperformers as of late. Still, in many cases, considered overbought by certain measures, but we'll watch to see if those momentum trades continue to move to the downside. That'll be something to key to watch there, Kelly. And
Dom,
for that,
you're our market guru, you're our Telestrator guru,
yes.
But got to step aside, my
All
friend, because
right.
I want to show a little action here.
I'm going to be socially
today.
Distantly responsible.
Yes, you're
later.
Not allowed to stick around. we're talking about momentum, as Dom was just outlining, especially in a couple of stocks today. But there are some parallels momentum-wise for the whole market that hark back to that market top in January 2018. Here's what we're talking about. Here's the S&P year-to-date. The purple line is the 200-day moving average. Notice what this is right here. That is a pretty stark gap. We are now 14% above that 200-day moving average. So again, levels that we're seeing that go back to what we saw at the market top in January of 2018. Hat tip to Peter Buchvar pointing this out. It's the same. Actually, it's worse for the NASDAQ. No surprise given the run that we've seen there. Look at this gap. We are now 22% above our 200-day moving average for the entire NASDAQ. And in case you're wondering, the relative strength index, the RSI, for the NASDAQ is now 71. Remember, anything over 70 usually indicates overbought. So if you're looking for some technicals to back up the trading action that we've seen, well, this can kind of give you a sense that, yeah, the numbers are getting a little stretched. Can the momentum last? To talk more about that, let's bring in Ariel Investments Vice Chair Charlie Wabrinskoy and Andres Garcia Amaya, who is the founder of Zoe Financial. It's great to have you both here, Charlie, especially you. You've been pounding the table for this rotation. Is it finally about to happen?
Who knows? You're right. We have been pounding the table. What we say is we know you can measure a bubble. You can see a bubble. You just can't tell when it's going to get pricked. And you know that value investing works, but you just don't know when. And I will admit it's been something that we've been calling for a while. But in the end, while overvaluations can last for a long, long time, eventually stocks go to where their cash flows say they should go.
And I thought it was interesting, Andres, that at the end of halftime when Liz said, you know, think about owning the S&P equal weight. You know, if you want to not have to just bet on one name versus another, but on that concept that maybe there's going to be some catch up here. Do you think that strategy makes sense?
I think that the beauty of having a passive approach on the markets is that the winners become a bigger part of your portfolio, right? In essence, you don't have to do your homework, right? Apple has done great the last 10 years, 15 years, and that's why it's one of the biggest positions in people's portfolio, right? So one of the things that I think is interesting is that question of when, right? When will the markets have a significant crash or downside? But the big question of when do you need your money back? Because if you're an investor, you're day trading, obviously that's a huge question, right? When are we going to see a huge downdraft? If you're investing to retire 10 years from now, that question of when you see a downdraft becomes less important because irrelevant of if the market's expensive or not, where are you going to put your money? Under the mattress?
Right.
Right. That's probably more dangerous than to keep it in the markets and wait for 10 years to at least get 3, 4, 5, 6% annualized returns.
But Charlie, what about those investors, some of the newer investors who say, well, my investment horizon is when Tesla trades lower, you know, when I start losing money in it, then I want to get out. I mean, that's the tricky thing.
That's the point. I think a lot of this move in names like Tesla, I think maybe Tesla being the most dramatic example of this, is people seeing their friends making easy money and thinking they can make easy money and putting more and more money into that trade that the person they're watching. This is what happened, obviously, in 07 when the housing market went crazy, when people saw their friends buying second homes with virtually no money down, and they said, I can do that. I can flip a house. And so they start trying to make easy money, and that kind of greed eventually pricks. When it starts to go the other way, it can go that way in a hurry.
And some of your individual stocks, Charlie, just so our viewers know, that you'd recommend include BorgWarner, Nielsen, and ViacomCBS. But I actually wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing some advice. So if you're listening right now and you're in some of these more speculative stocks, then here's Charlie Babrinskoy here to tell you, here's your one piece of kind of market advice. I mean, what would you recommend? What's the better strategy right now?
It is to be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. And right now, people are being greedy on some of these names. And so don't buy the names that have outperformed the 300-day moving average. That's just a sign of momentum. Invest in things based on the intrinsic value of those securities. And that's not that hard. Companies have predictable earnings in many cases. And so the names that you just read are all trading for less than 12 times earnings. And then avoid things that are overpriced, like long-term bonds. Bonds are almost as big a bubble as growth stocks and tech stocks right now. So invest in intrinsic value.
All right. Now, Andres, I'll give you the last word here, whether you'd echo those thoughts or maybe add any others.
So the motto I would use is, if you're going to be greedy, be long-term greedy rather than short-term greedy. What I mean by that is, if you're going to own stocks, own it for the next 10 years, right? You know, try to make a quick buck on Tesla's earnings.
Yeah, I like you. Sound like a very old man, Andres, who's been through, seen a few. And you're not. You've got the wisdom. But yeah,
it's what works in the long term. Ask Warren Buffett.
Well, you still got the hair, gentlemen. Thank you both very, very much today. Do appreciate it. This market juncture, Charlie Babrinskoy and Andres Garcia Amaya. Now to the Trump administration announcing that the CDC, yes, will invoke its authority to halt evictions through the end of the year in an effort to slow the spread of coronavirus. The move does come with concerns about potential fraud. Here to tell us more about it, Diana Olick. Diana?
Yeah, Kelly, both landlord and tenant advocates, though, say this does not go far enough. But through an order by the CDC, the Trump administration delayed most potential evictions until the end of this year. Now, to qualify for protections, tenants must make less than $99,000 a year or couples up to $198,000. Tenants have to sign legal documents claiming they tried to take advantage of federal housing aid in order to pay their rent. They also must claim that they are unable to pay due to COVID-related financial hardship, and if they are evicted, they would likely become homeless or have to move into unsafe settings. Now, the CDC order specifically said eviction moratoria, like quarantine, isolation, and social distancing, can be an effective public health measure to prevent the spread of disease. The order did not refer to any contracts between landlords and tenants, so you can definitely expect some lawsuits. There is potential for fraud, though, by tenants who don't actually have to provide any hardship or prove it. Critics say this sorely lacks the rental aid needed and creates a snowball effect of debt for both tenants and landlords that could have a significant effect on the health of the entire housing market going forward. Kelly?
So is there anything in here for landlords, Diana, to kind of compensate for this fact?
Well, not really. On a call with the Trump administration officials last night, they said that there was some money in some extra HUD funding, community development block grants. But when you talk to the experts, they say most of that government relief is gone already. And landlords, remember, they have to pay their own mortgages. They have to pay their taxes. They have to pay all kinds of expenses on these properties. And many of them, for them, it's their only income as well.
Yeah. Diana, we appreciate it. Thank you very much, Diana Olick, following that story for us. Still ahead, we are checking in with the leading recruiting firm on the job trends that they're seeing. For the first time since April, healthcare is not one of the top hiring industries. And who is might surprise you. Plus, from Avatar teachers to smart buses, school's going to look pretty different this fall. We'll look at some of the changes that could stick post-pandemic. And if you're in the market for a bicycle, good luck. It's the next product in our Out of Stock series. The CEO of Trek joins us live ahead.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back. It's a pivotal week for the labor market. Weekly jobless claims are out tomorrow. And then on Friday, we get the all-important monthly jobs report. A new report from Recruiter.com gives us an optimistic look at hiring trends and shows where the jobs are cropping up right now. Joining me to talk more about it, Evan Sohn is CEO and chair of Recruiter.com. Evan, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me back, Kelly.
So your survey overall ticked up a bit this month, but it's interesting to go back and reflect on July when even when you saw it tick down just a little, the jobs report, the monthly jobs report from the Labor Department was very strong. So it would seem that you are picking up on some strength both in July and August and in the labor market in general, that for whatever reason, the ADP survey is not picking up in the same way, or perhaps it just kind of speaks to that not all of this discussion about hiring is going to show up right away in terms of the job numbers.
That's right. And, you know, we had this theory when we launched the Recruiter Index really at the beginning of the pandemic that recruiters could really serve as the air traffic controllers for the hiring industry and give a really good sentiment. And last month we reported that the acceleration had slowed, but not nearly the cliff that Wall Street was reporting.
Right. And so let's talk about what you have here for this month. So in August, you've even seen your sentiment tick up. So we're talking about a move from 3.1 to 3.2. You said across every metric, August saw improvements over July. Recruiters are more confident about the current job market and prospects over the next 30 days. Interestingly, the top industries here, computer software and IT, not surprisingly, but tell me about manufacturing.
Yeah, so I think there's been a real push to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States, and we're seeing that from the recruiters' sentiment and the demand that they're seeing for those jobs.
It's incredible because that's a very long-term trend, but there's clearly a post-pandemic rebound effect that's also at play. I mean, we saw in the ISM manufacturing survey yesterday a very strong headline number, a very, very strong new orders number, and this would suggest that that's not a fluke, that there's some strength in that industry right now, yes?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. So we're certainly seeing that, and our data suggests that the 1.1 million that's being forecasted is really not a stretch. We do see, and we started to look at data year over year workloads, and they are down from last year. So we're down about 26% from the workloads of August 2019. It's actually an improvement. We were down 32% in July 2020 compared to July 2019. So we are seeing that gap sort of slowly return to normal. We're going to really keep a very close look at that trend to see whether that continues.
And tell me about healthcare, which is for the first time since April, not one of the three most optimistic industries. In a way, is that good news that they're not scrambling to deal with COVID right now?
Yeah, so one thing, if you just step back and you look at last year's numbers, the jobs report for August 2019, they added 130,000 jobs in 2019. So even the most pessimistic reports today are more than three times last year's numbers. So we're certainly making a lot of progress. I think it really points to the challenge of hiring faster.
And we're seeing first in June where lots of jobs came back really quickly. And now we're seeing how do we bring on more people on a month-by-month basis. And healthcare could be one of those areas. We're seeing how do I have job openings for nursing, but I got to go find those nurses. And we're seeing those sort of challenges facing the healthcare industry.
You know, just anecdotally around town, I've been surprised at the number of restaurants that have help wanted signs up. You know, because they're operating at much reduced capacity, and yet they still seem to need people. I don't know if that's because some don't feel comfortable going back or what the story is, but when you talk about needing to hire faster, tell me about that and whether that's a new thing or you think something that is changing about the way we hire people.
Yeah, so, you know, look, we internally we call it the great rehire. You know, how do you take these millions of people that have lost their job and get them rehired? That's going to take something new, a new process, a new technology, a new way of thinking. Think about, we added, you know, even on the pessimistic numbers, 400, you know, plus thousand that they're talking about on the pessimistic side. That's a tremendous increase from last year. Think about the workload and getting those people on board. So something's going to have to change for us to bring these millions of people back to the workforce.
And what might that be?
We're probably going to start looking at AI technology and different screening technology. You know, every interview that we've all done for our jobs were done in person. That's going to change. So we really need to think about hiring in a different fashion. You know, your first interview is not going to be done in person, probably your second, probably your third. So things are going to have to change. Screening out people, how do you do that quickly and faster? And that's really become really a mission of mine, is how do we help people get back to work quickly?
Yeah, it's like a giant matching problem, which that's we right. know in many ways economics has solved really well in other industries and maybe now can do for this one too.
Right. I'll give you a great example. You mentioned that restaurant before. If that restaurateur posted a job ad for an employee, that restaurant owner would be bombarded with hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of applicants. That also creates an issue, right? When you have this influx of people looking for the same job, how do you figure out who the right person is and how do you move that process along the way? And frankly, we don't have the time to take the same amount of time it used to take to onboard employees as we do today to get the economy to return to normal.
100%. Evan Sohn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kelly.
A great insight about what's going on with the labor market today. And like he said, maybe 1.1 million, not a stretch for the jobs report Friday. I want to show you the Dow and S&P, which are at session highs right now. Dow climbing nearly 300 points, a 1% gain, same exact percentage gain for the S&P today. And the NASDAQ trailing, it's up 0.5% as some of the big momentum names have struggled. Coming up, school will look very different this fall and maybe forever. The new ways of teaching as a result of the pandemic is next. Plus, momentum stocks are falling behind today. Is this just a temporary slowdown as you see Tesla, Zoom, and Salesforce all in the red? Or could this be the start of a downward trend? We'll explore that coming up.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
For over 130 years, McCormick has helped you make mom's lasagna to keep her secret recipe alive. Take over taco night, no matter how chaotic your day is. Conquer the bake sale, even if you get to it last minute. And craft the perfect Sunday brunch when it's not even Sunday. Because with McCormick by your side, it's gonna be great.
Welcome back to The Exchange, where it's session highs pretty much in the markets right now. Here's a look at what's going on, where it's pretty much strength for the Dow and the S&P, the broad market, but not so much for the NASDAQ today. Very different look and feel to the markets than we've seen for the last couple weeks and really months even. So the Dow's up 300 points, S&P's up 37, 1% gains. The NASDAQ's only up 0.5%, but look, it's over 12,000, which is remarkable to see. So behind me are the sectors and utilities are in the leadership today. That just tells you what kind of market this is. It's almost like they read the Barron's piece saying, why haven't they participated? And they're making up for lost time. They're up 3%. The only sector in the red today is energy, although technology is the weakest of the strong, if that makes sense. It's up 0.5% right now. We're watching closely. A number of the momentum names like Apple and Tesla moving to the downside today. Here are some of the other movers this hour, including Smile Direct Club, which is higher following nearly 2 million share purchases by some of the executive team, including the CEO, who upped his stake by nearly 13 million shares. Smile Direct is up nearly 19% today to about $9.35. AMC is higher on news it'll open another 140 theaters this week and plans to have 70% of all AMC theaters in the U.S. reopened by this weekend, 14% gain for AMC to just under $7 a share. And finally, Peloton is higher. So much for all the momentum names, not Peloton dropping today. J.P. Morgan raised its price target on Peloton to 105. It's now the street high, noting that current delivery delays aren't optimal, but they bode well for ongoing demand and sustained top-line strength. Peloton is up 8% today and more than 200% year-to-date. Now let's get to Sue Herrera for our CNBC News update. Sue?
Thank you so much, Kelly. Here's what's happening at this hour, everyone. Amtrak will furlough at least 2,000 workers as part of cutbacks for the next year. The cuts reflect efforts by Amtrak to reduce or suspend daily service on most long-distance routes. Miami-Dade public schools are being targeted by cyber attacks for the third day in a row. The attacks have caused complete internet outages and have prevented students and teachers from being able to access the district's servers. Unilever will invest about $1.2 billion to eliminate fossil fuels from its cleaning products by 2030 and use plant-based and other biologically sourced ingredients instead. And the U.S. will now require Chinese diplomats to get State Department approval before visiting U.S. university campuses and holding cultural events with more than 50 people. The move comes as tensions between the two countries are heating up over influence operations and espionage activities. You are up to date, Kel. That's the news update. Back to you.
All right, Sue, thank you very much. Online education stocks have seen big gains since the March lows, with Chegg leading the way, up more than 150%. The only thing we do know about learning this year is that a lot of it will be done online. What's less certain is what exactly virtual classrooms will look like. For more on that, I'm joined by Elon Moy. Elon?
Well, Kelly, for better or for worse, the coronavirus is forcing many schools to embrace all of these new technologies and accelerating the shift to a connected classroom. And some of those lessons will outlast the pandemic.
Center to center.
The coronavirus is changing America's classrooms in some concrete ways, like socially distant desks, sanitation stations, and stockpiles of PPE. Other changes are less tangible, but more fundamental, as the pandemic turns the old model of education upside down.
One thing that we've learned along the way, that we have got to think differently about creating a new normal within education.
Across the country, that means embracing virtual learning, despite the groans of parents and teachers. Experts say the virus is speeding up the technological disruption in our schools, maybe permanently.
We were marching a certain direction, leveraging software, leveraging the digital medium for teaching and learning. And what this did is really accelerated our path.
Hold on. Let's review inanely.
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt uses the same kind of technology that retailers do to tailor lessons to students using this avatar, Amira. Eventually, once the pandemic is over, classrooms could be transformed into connected learning environments where technology isn't a replacement for school, but an extension of it. Still, all this online learning requires access to the internet, and the virus has exposed the digital divide in America's schools. Now, districts are racing to provide students with laptops and MiFis, even buses that double as internet hotspots.
We've had to reimagine about what we do instructionally, and in order to provide that connectivity and also to provide robust learning experiences every single day.
Now, Hillsborough has already spent $7 million on mobile devices for students, expecting to spend another $15 million this school year. Kelly, that is a lot of money, but they hope that this will be a long-term investment.
What are some of the other ways, Elon, that you think we're going to have schooling and the way that we get to school and do school and the number that you think might permanently change as a result of all this?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things here is that hybrid learning has really come to the fore as a potential bridge between what you can do at home and what you can do in the classroom. And I think that teachers are also getting really innovative about how they deliver that instruction online. There are all the fancy tools that we talked about in the package, but also I just got off of the virtual orientation for my kindergartners own classroom, and his teacher had the idea of creating a play bucket in which all of the building supplies were right there for them, and they could still build towers together even across a video platform. So you're going to see a lot of innovation amongst the teachers themselves and then sort of wider within the industry space.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right about that. Elon, thank you very much. Elon Moy with a glimpse of the present and future. Coming up, Michael Jordan's new job, credit cards rethink rewards, and Sin City needs sense. That's with a C, maybe an S. All that and more ahead in today's edition of Rapid Fire right after this. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a couple stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines are Dom Chu, Contessa Brewer, and Robert Frank. Contessa in the middle of Manhattan, I think. Middle of town somewhere. Anyway, welcome, everybody. The first story today is that more companies are looking to cash in on the tech craze. Mobile gaming company and two-time CNBC disruptor Skillz with a Z plans to go public by merging with a SPAC, special purpose acquisition company. That's continuing a trend that's picked up a lot of steam this year. Bumble, the dating app, is reportedly planning an IPO early next year at a valuation between $6 and $8 billion with a B. Contessa, is this a sign that the markets are too frothy or that time is ripe for these kinds of companies?
Live from Kingston, New York right now, just to be clear about where I am. I'm wondering whether they're just making hay while the sun shines. It looks like if a SPAC is the way to get you into public, if you can save some fees by doing it, if you can generate some excitement, then why not do it? Take Skillz, for instance. This is a company that in April and in the second quarter had 2.6 million users. Now it expects to be valued at more than $4 billion. That values essentially each of these game players at more than $1,600. It's a very expensive way to look at mobile gaming, and you got to wonder how much more can they grow from here? What ways can they use their technology to expand in new fields and start to bring in that cash?
Yeah, the executives behind this company also brought DraftKings to market. We'll talk more about that, Dom, in a minute, but they do have a track record here, even though for me, Skillz is not exactly a household name. What do you make of the valuations for them in Bumble?
So the valuations are the key here, right? I mean, this idea that you can do this kind of an offering, whether it's the traditional IPO process possibly for a company like Bumble or whether it's a special acquisition company like for Skillz, what it tells you right now is that there is a time that investors will tolerate the kinds of valuations that we are seeing. It's not that it's excessive. It's just richly valued compared to the last couple of months, the last few years. However, what it does tell you is that with the market at record highs, there are parts of the market right now that people still want to flock to, and people still have IPO fever when it comes to a good name. And that's what it tells me. I don't know. You asked whether or not it's froth. I think it's a little bit frothy, but I'm not sure you can say that it's a total bubblicious environment just yet.
Well, and it goes well with the whole first three stories here kind of have share a theme, Robert. So I'm going to go ahead with that one and ask what the implications are. The New York Stock Exchange's plan to let companies raise capital through direct listings. Remember, the direct listing was something even Airbnb was looking at using. I think Slack used it. A number of big name companies have gone public this way. But now the NYSE's plans are on hold after the Council for Institutional Investors took an unusual regulatory step. It filed notice with the SEC petitioning for a review of the proposal, saying these direct listings let companies circumvent protections for investors, Robert, that are built into the IPO process. So as the types of paths to go public multiply, perhaps the backlash here.
Yeah, look, I think we're in this rare window with the market where investors are a little less discriminating, shall we say, about what they're buying. So we're seeing SPACs, we're seeing direct listings, whereas perhaps in the past, investors might have been a little more cautious and markets might have been a little more cautious about approving these things. But I think anything that disrupts the racket of IPOs, which is really a theme machine for Wall Street, you know, with the green shoes and the backdoor allotments and the book building, I mean, it's such a Byzantine process, very expensive. So I think anything that simplifies this but still gets the information and disclosure to investors, I think that's the key, the sort of S1 component of the IPO. As long as you have that,
I think it's fine to go around Wall Street and get it directly to shareholders.
Although, Dom, it was interesting because a lot of the direct listings, I remember there was has been a lot of analysis about whether they are just as expensive as the typical IPO. And certainly the SPAC option would seem to be more costly.
So if you're talking about the reason why there's a little bit of pushback against this idea of a direct listing, if you're going to use the I don't want to say excuse, if you're going to use the thesis that it doesn't protect investors as much as the scrutiny around a traditional IPO process, I'm not sure I buy into that as much. The reason why is if you're a retail investor out there, not many retail investors actually get allocations to some of these hot IPOs. Who does get allocations are mutual fund managers, other large institutional investors and hedge funds who presumably can do the amount of legwork and homework that's required to scrutinize these companies before investing in them. So I'm not sure if it's that big of a deal on that front, Kel.
Contessa.
So, Dom, I'm just kind of wondering, the Council of Institutional Investors, who's protesting this kind of alternative to the IPO at the New York Stock Exchange, they represent pension funds and foundations and those large institutional investors. Could there be a reason why they want to elbow out the competition from these, say, a retail investor? If someone from Robinhood wants to get in on the ground floor, they can't really do it on regular IPOs.
Nobody can. But this idea of having institutional investors be the ones that are kind of protesting this, that's why I'm not exactly I don't buy into it as much. Only because if you're a T. Rowe Price or you're a Fidelity, or you're a portfolio manager at Vanguard or anyone else who might be getting allocations to somebody, not that Vanguard really does, but if you're an active manager who's scrutinizing stocks and picking those types of things, I don't feel as though you are as exposed to this as, say, myself, who may not be able to do the due diligence on getting into an IPO. Yeah. So I'm not sure it really kind of resonates that much with me.
So it's like big name buyer beware. Like we want to protect the little guy, but the bigger guy, like, good luck to you. You're on your own. Maybe if I'm a company, hence the appeal of the direct listing. I mentioned DraftKings earlier. Let's circle back to that. Because their big story today is that the greatest basketball player, one of them, I don't want to get into the whole argument. What is it, LeBron? What do we say? Robert's nodding. It's Jordan. Okay, it's Jordan. The greatest basketball player of all time is taking his talents to the sports gambling world. Michael Jordan is taking an equity stake in DraftKings in exchange for becoming a special advisor to the company. The shares were up as much as 21% this morning. They're up about 8% right now. DraftKings has gone from a less than $1 billion market cap company, what became public in April through a SPAC, to a more than almost $14 billion company today, Robert.
Yeah, setting aside basketball, Michael Jordan is the greatest of all time at wealth creation from sports. There is no one else even close. So just today,
Shaq,
he added $800 million to the market cap of DraftKings. $800 million just by adding his name to the DraftKings board. Setting aside that this is a guy who can sell his old sneakers for $600,000, he's worth somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion. There is no one even close to Michael Jordan when it comes to creating wealth and value.
Even Shaq, Robert?
How about Tiger Woods?
Not yet. But look at Michael. You add in the sneakers, his ownership of a team. I mean, Jordan has taken it to a level that no one else is close.
The other thing, Contessa, that is interesting to me about this is it shows how mainstream gambling has gone. I mean, this used to be something that was whispered about, and now it's, like the leading news story in the business world.
The owner of a professional sports team is going to be on the board of a gambling company.
Yeah.
The intertwining of these businesses is unbelievable. And I'm wondering whether DraftKings just said, are you kidding me? I get to be in a board meeting with Michael Jordan. Bring him on. How much of the company do we have to get him at the board meeting? How cool is that? But there is some pushback from the analysts. Look, you've got DraftKings, as you were mentioning the valuation here. DraftKings is now, in terms of market cap, bigger than MGM Resorts, bigger than Wynn Resorts. So you have to question how much room is there to run, especially when they're not making the money yet. And is Michael Jordan going to be the Midas touch that turns that tide?
And I think you make an interesting point. We have to move on. But this is the owner of a team who's now on the board of a sports and gambling company. Let's just sit with that for a while. In the meantime, we'll say goodbye to airline miles and hotel points and say hello to delivery and takeout. Because a new piece in the Wall Street Journal today looks at credit cards as they scramble to update their customer benefits to more pandemic-friendly offerings. Remember, business travels at a standstill. One executive said she saw cardholders cashing in their points, Dom, for hair dryers and golf balls.
Changing paradigms, right?
And remember, you think?
I remember how many times we've done stories, and our friends over at CNBC Select and everyone else who kind of evaluates these credit cards used to look at them from different perspectives. If you were an avid traveler, a business traveler, or a leisure traveler, a certain specific type of card was more geared towards you because it was better with regard to dining miles or airline miles or the way that you could redeem points for vacations and things like that. Well, now that no one's taking them, you have to adjust these things. And with cards, what I'm finding curious is that this particular pandemic will then converge many of the benefits for these cards together because you cannot offer some of the outsized benefits for travel. I'm curious about whether the commoditization of credit cards and point redemption is going to go this way, because you can pretty much get a hairdryer or a gift anywhere in any card. Maybe right. That Chase Sapphire Reserve doesn't do as much for you as it used to because you can't travel.
Robert, quick last word on this one, but what do you think the new kind of like perk can and should be?
Well, look, I like the American Express Business Platinum card is offering free subscription to the meditation app Calm, which I think we could all use right now. So I think that's a good idea.
That is definitely a sign of the times. All right, finally, and before we go, that's the sound people want to hear when they're in Vegas playing the slots. But the national coin shortage has a lot of casinos pinching pennies during the pandemic. Contessa, there's a really bad coin shortage in Vegas, isn't there? But this only affects some of the smaller casinos, is that right?
Well, you would think, because the coin slot machines have gone the way of, say, a coin parking meter. You know, now when you go out and you park, you can find these parking meters that also you can pay with an app, and it leaves you, if you only have pennies, just fine, I'll just pay with my phone. In Las Vegas, they are still having a problem with coin shortages, because when you go to cash in your ticket, you don't usually get it rounded to the dollar. You have some change left. And the casinos are coming up with innovative ways to find enough cash, coins, to pay back their players. So, for instance, Boyd told us they have redemption machines where people can bring in their piggy banks and dump in their coins and get paid for that. Churchill Downs says they're having trouble finding enough coins to pay out those tickets. But El Cortez, one of the oldest continuously running casinos in Las Vegas, used to be owned by Bugsy Siegel, says there's a real problem. When they reopened, they ordered $30,000 in coins from Brinks. You know how much they got? $500.
Wow.
They have more than 100 coin slots still in use. And it's a big draw for this company. People who want to hear that change dumping into the tray go to the El Cortez because they have it. And here they're having to take away the fee on those change machines, the coin redemption machines.
Dom, let's just make sure everybody caught that. We have casinos asking people to bring in their piggy banks. So mom and dad are going to your piggy bank to empty it out to go play the slot.
This is going to breed some innovation. Here's what I would say. If you're a casino owner out there and you've got a robust food and beverage operation, here's what I'd say. Develop a scheme, some kind of a system where people can kind of round up their change into vouchers for food and beverage. That way you never have to pay out any of that cash. All you have to pay out is whole dollar amounts, and the more you build up into that, this is going to drive a lot of activity towards these reward cards that all these casinos have, because then you can bank some of those credits and just use them for that free buffet. I'm a buffet guy, so I would take my spare change and get a buffet out of that.
I don't know. It's post-pandemic, Dom. You may want to think twice about that. Thank you, everybody, very much today for your time. Dominic Chu, Contessa Brewer, and Robert Frank. Coming up, momentum stocks only seem to move in one direction lately, up. But today's a different story. Are the overcrowded trades finally starting to crack? That's next. Welcome back. If you're standing right now, you might want to sit down for what I'm about to say, because believe it or not, Tesla is lower today. It's down more than 6%. It's its second down day now. Apple is also in the red. Apple's down 6% at the lows. It shed a Boeing in market cap. And how about Zoom? That one also falling after shooting up 49% in the past three trading days. And the new Dow darling, Salesforce, it's also in the red. And this is only its second down day in 2 weeks. So while it may be too early to call it a trend, what are all of these declines telling us about the broader market? For more, let's welcome in CNBC senior markets commentator Michael Santoli, along with Michael Kantrowitz, chief investment strategist at Cornerstone Macro. It's good to have you guys here. Kantrowitz, I'll start with you because your note, it makes me chuckle. You say crowding is at an extreme, but stay growthy. Why?
Yeah. Well, we have a backdrop now where you have more crowding than ever by some measures. Looking at just how crowded, how many institutional owners do own stocks relative to average stocks, and it's even higher today than 8,000. The question, though, and we'll say stake the, is really about fundamentals, the reason that these are crowded. And the question is, did something change today? Something going to change that is going to change the story about why investors like these stocks? And really, valuation has been, you know, the single biggest issue for most of these names. Yet we continue to see them outperform because the fundamental story is still intact.
And what is that fundamental story, real quick?
It's from a macro perspective. It's a continued backdrop, very low interest rate, staying a long time. It's a lack of stocks elsewhere. The reality is in the S&P 100, there are only 50, 60 names that have actually gone their revenue anywhere, those stocks that you just did. And so it's not going to change. Investors aren't going
to
change.
Michael Santoli, let me turn to you then. So I think essentially what Kantrowitz is saying is that you have super low interest rates. We've seen even after the big Fed move last week, that's still the case. People want growth because they're not confident of where else they might get it. But is that piece of it starting to change when you see the better manufacturing surveys, hear about the industry's hiring?
It's starting to change, Kelly, in the sense that the only game in town may no longer be those long-term secular growth stories that have these durable cash flows, which have been revalued much higher, given the fact that, you know, we have corporate bond yields at 2% and an easy Fed. It's actually broadened out quite a bit in the last several weeks. If you look at things like industrial and transport stocks, if you look at consumer discretionary outside of Amazon compared to more defensive things like consumer staples, those things have been trending in a positive direction, just not as dramatically. They're just not capable of piling on the amount of market cap that the huge growth stocks are. And also, let's face it, they don't captivate this sort of public, the excitement that you have around a handful of names that really drove them to extremes. You know, the setup that you had for this segment, presuming everyone already figures all these stocks are up every day.
Right.
That's exactly why they're not up every day like today.
So what happens now? Because it's one thing when you say, hey, you know, Virgin Galactic was up and then it's a tiny name in the grand scheme of things. But when Tesla, Mike Santoli, is like the eighth biggest stock in the world at this point, what happens if that one reverses and gives up, you know, the majority of its gains?
Well, we're seeing a small experiment in that right now. It's off the highs. You know, the rest of the market, in fact, if anything, the weakness today, this reversal that you've seen to the downside in some of the momentum stocks, it's incredibly localized at the moment. I mean, it's Apple, it's Tesla, it's Zoom. It's the stocks that everybody was complaining about. They were up every day going into today, and we have an overall market that's actually up. So you do have a little bit of a safety net underneath it. It can't last forever. That choreography, of course, might fail at some point where you have this sort of rotation and this rebalancing in other areas of the market. But I do think the fact that Apple can be down as much as it is and how much market cap it has and the rest of the market more or less absorbs it, you know, at least for now, it's okay. Even if stuff is so overbought on the tech side that even much more of a give back, a normal pullback is about 7% in the NASDAQ 100 right now. Extremely normal, like we've had multiple times in the past few months.
And I like your point about how Apple, the $2 trillion company, can be down as much as it is and the rest of the market marches higher. Like you said, we'll see if that continues. But for now, Michael Santoli, Michael Kantrowitz, thank you both very, very much talking about Momo in this market. Still ahead, high-end bicycle maker Trek has seen record sales during the pandemic. The CFO on why two wheels are so hot right now and the Trek products consumers can't get their hands on. You can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. We're back in a couple. As the pandemic changes the way we commute, people have been scrambling to buy bicycles, causing major shortages. City or suburb, it's nearly impossible to find bikes, particularly Trek bikes. The surge in demand coincided almost immediately with the lockdowns. According to NPD Group, bike sales soared a whopping 75% in April, and it's not showing a lot of signs of stopping. Sales are sustaining those gains up 63% in June. With me now is Chad Brown. He's the CFO and Vice President of Retail at Trek. Chad, it's good to see you. And bike theft, by the way, is up big time because people are trying to get their hands on this stuff.
Yeah, well, when you buy your bike, also buy a lock.
Yeah, exactly. Before diving into that aspect of this, tell me, first of all, you know, we've talked about how Amazon says it's basically every day is Prime Day, or Apple says, you know, the last quarter they were selling computers as if it were Christmas. I mean, what's this period been like for you guys?
You know, this year is really two different periods. The first part of the year, the bike business has been doing well for a couple of years now, and really up through, you know, the first 2 weeks of March, things were up 10-15% in it as an industry. Things were going well. And then, you know, the bike season really starts about March 15th. So like Christmas Eve, things started shutting down. And as bike shops were deemed essential retail, very quickly we saw some really unique shopping patterns. And demand that first couple weeks in April just took off. For us, the inflection point was really Easter weekend, that April 12th date. We looked at our weekend sell-through reports and what was happening in the market, and it was just soaring. So yeah, it's really been a rocket ship since then.
I imagine it's some people maybe using it as an alternative way to commute if they don't want to, you know, do it maybe an Uber or a mass transit or something. A lot of it, though, is recreational, and we've seen people on bikes constantly streaming through the neighborhood. In fact, we tried to get a bike in those little ride-along things for toddlers, and we were told by our local bike shop, not only leave, don't even bother asking, but don't even bother coming back for a couple of months, because they said there's no supply. Why is the supply of bikes totally unable to keep up with the demand?
Yeah, well, I'm so sorry that you had that experience. I would love to have you into one of our truck retail stores or one of our truck retailers. You know, the boom happened, and really early on, we saw, like, after everyone bought the toilet paper, they bought kids' bikes and then entry-level mountain bikes. And then as supply started to get tight, it worked its way up. You know, from our perspective, we took a wait-and-see approach as the as both the pandemic took hold as well as the surge in demand. And, you know, we're still shipping out tens of thousands of bikes, you know, every week. So there are bikes out there, I promise. Call your store, reach out to your truck retailer. There are bikes available, and there are a lot more on the way. There are a lot more on the way. You know, the early shutdown in Asia part of this year did have a little bit of a hiccup in the supply, but I promise you there are a lot more bikes on the way.
Yeah, the only options that we had, you could get this sort of oddly tall one with these really high handlebars. I mean, they had a couple, but not really anything great to pick from. So how do you think this sets you guys up for the future? Because if now every household has purchased a bike, does that mean we're going to have a big hangover and things become unusually slow for a period of time?
You know, we're still seeing, when you look at indicators like foot traffic and call volume and even just website traffic, we're still seeing a lot of pent-up demand. There are you know, there are empty slots on some of the bike shop floors, but there are a lot of people that have bikes on orders, and a lot of the bikes that are, you know, being delivered to the stores are maybe already spoken for, or the shop has an idea of who might already be interested in that. There are a lot of bikes coming, though. I promise you, you know, come Christmas time, you know, if a kid wants a bike, or if you're looking for, you know, something for a friend or a partner,
yeah,
bikes available. And I think, you know, we're looking at this as an amazing opportunity. There are all these people that are on bikes now, whether they're using it for recreation or transportation, yeah, or just as a way to social distance. It's such a great opportunity to get people outside and off screens, you know, enjoying the bicycle.
Yeah, and you guys think it'll stick. My message to me is there are a lot of bikes on the way, and
there
we'll look forward to that.
Head just south to our store in Edgewater.
And, yeah, I don't know. They're a little too upscale for our needs, but Chad, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, sir. Chad Brown of Trek joining us today. That does it for The Exchange. After this, the Fed's latest read on the economy, the Beige Book. Don't go anywhere.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.